clear example of lawlessness, injustice and cruelty. Activists echoed this sentiment, stating that the ruling party aims to reduce Muslims to second-class citizens with limited civil liberties, unable to even protest for their constitutionally guaranteed fundamental rights.
We have to understand that these are essential elements of the ideology of Bharatiya Janata Party, and all these acts are aimed at marginalizing Muslims and criminalizing all aspects of their life and to restrain their living. That is the ideology of Bharatiya Janata Party. We have to understand it, and therefore we call it fascism.
Rights activists and observers say that since the ruling party came to power in 2014, Muslims have faced systematic repression, including hate speeches, hate crimes, mob lynching, the new citizenship law, and now the push for a uniform civil code and the seizure of Muslim charitable properties, Waqf. Activists say the aim is to disempower Muslims as a part of a larger political agenda to create a unified Hindu First India. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
On Tuesday, foreign ministers from seven of the world's major economies gathered for a second day of talks in the historic town of Fuji, southeast of Rome. During the two-day summit, the ministers of Italy, US, Canada, UK, France, Germany and Japan discussed the situation in West Asia, Ukraine and in the Indo-Pacific as pressure to advance diplomatic efforts to resolve crisis in these regions is mounting. A group of pro-Palestine protesters staged a static demonstration in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians in the vicinity of the venue of the summit meeting. The G7 countries have provided political support for the Israeli regime and have significantly contributed to increasing insecurity and instability in West Asia, particularly through the U.S. military and financial support for Tel Aviv.
This is the G7 summit of genocide. All countries involved are Israel's major accomplices. Not only the US and the EU have unconditionally provided weapons to Netanyahu, but they have not done anything to stop the genocide. They have never condemned Israel for its atrocities. Furthermore, they are trying to delegitimize the International Criminal Court after arrest warrants against Netanyahu and Gallant were issued.
During the protest, international law experts explained that Italy must abide by the ICC's rulings, being one of the early signatories of the treaty that established the International Criminal Court.
I hope the ICC will issue arrest warrants also for all individuals from the US and the EU administrations and for whoever has violated international norms. Enough with this unbearable double standard. Enough with Israel's impunity.
The G7 summit saw the European Union's outgoing foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, say there are no excuses for Israel to refuse to accept a ceasefire with the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah.
We demand an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, but above all that Israel ends its carnage, its ethnic cleansing, its genocide, which some still find it hard to call it this way.
For the first time, the G7 ministers were joined by their counterparts from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, as well as the Secretary General of the Arab League, Max Civili, Fuji.
Dozens of medical professionals and health workers gathered in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, united in outrage and grief. Their protests aimed to highlight the ongoing violence in Gaza and Lebanon, denouncing what they called Israel's deliberate attacks on hospitals, doctors and patients.
Our protest today is not only for the health sector in Sana'a, but also in the rest of the governorates. It is a show of solidarity with the Palestinian and Lebanese people, especially the health sector that is suffering greatly amid the ongoing Israeli aggression. We here want to express our full solidarity and our condemnation of the humanitarian and health violations that are taking place.
The demonstrators didn't mince words, accusing Israel of genocide and calling on the international community to take urgent action. They urged the United Nations to pressure Tel Aviv to halt its aggression, which has left more than 54,000 people dead or missing and over 100,000 injured in Gaza alone over the past year.
We declare our full solidarity with Gaza and Lebanon against the direct and systematic violation and targeting by the Zionist entity against health cadres and infrastructure and putting them out of service. We have previously suffered from the U.S.-backed Saudi aggression, so we declare our readiness to go to Gaza and Lebanon to save civilians there.
Among the chants and placards, a sense of vindication was palpable. The group hailed the International Criminal Court's recent arrest warrants for Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Minister of Military Affairs Yoav Gallant. For these demonstrators, it's a rare moment of justice in what they describe as a dark chapter of impunity.
For these health workers in Sana'a, the protest is more than a display of solidarity. They see it as a moral obligation to stand against what they describe as crimes against humanity. Their message to the international community is clear. It's time for accountability and action. Abdul Latif Al-Washalib, Sana'a.
Canaan, the sixth edition of the Palestine Film Festival, opened in the Austrian capital Vienna on Monday night. The event aims to create a platform for Palestinian filmmakers and films that address the lives and resistance of Palestinians in Palestine. Organizers told Press TV that it brings the stories and culture of Palestinians closer to the Viennese audience.
To support the Palestinian cause. And this is one of our main aims with this festival, to demonstrate that Palestinians are not only a fighting people fighting for their survival, but they are ready and they prove that they have a long tradition, they have culture, they are educated, and they have, in the meantime, there are many Palestinian film directors who got prizes.
On the first night, the film days opened with the recently completed film Where Olive Trees Weep, by Zaya and Maurizio Benazzo. It provides a magnificent and shocking insight into the everyday life, struggles and resilience of the Palestinian people under the Israeli regime's occupation.
There is a certain mobilization, and our festival is part of this kind of mobilization of information to demonstrate people are supporting the Palestinians and motivate other people to do the same.
The Palestine Film Days were opened by Palestinian Ambassador Salah Abdel Shafi and attended by several other representatives and diplomats who used the event to show solidarity with Palestine. Among those were the ambassadors of Algeria and Malaysia. Over the coming days, movies about the 1948 Nakba, life under occupation in Al-Khalil, and the resistance of Bedouin community will be screened. Due to the overwhelming success of the Palestine Film Days, the organizers are already preparing for a seventh edition of the event in the coming spring.
Most film screenings were sold out before the festival. This despite a complete media blackout. The success of the festival is therefore a stark reminder of the solidarity with Palestine in Austria. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
When the world speaks of women empowerment, the world remembers names of women who changed science, business, and politics. Today, the world will remember not just the names, but the faces of women changing humanity and defining the concept of strength itself in Gaza and in Lebanon. Earlier this month, the UN Human Rights Office declared that 70% of those killed by Israel in Gaza were women and children. The UN data estimates that over 10,000 women in Gaza have been killed, over 19,000 have been wounded, over 3,000 have become widows, and 37 mothers are killed every day. Hundreds of women have been killed in Lebanon, while many have lost their husbands and their children, and thousands have been left without homes. The UN Women Office in New York declined to give us a statement when we notified them that the report was about Gaza. But we got the chance to speak to the head of the United Nations Population Fund office in Gaza, who put into perspective the situation on the ground.
So this war, it's a year, it's over a year now, and each other day, women are exposed to very high levels of risk. This is a place right now with the highest levels of indignity. Indignity for a woman. Access, like you said, to sanitary and hygiene materials is very, very difficult. Even when the humanitarian community, including the United Nations, has a lot of such materials procured, access to Gaza becomes very difficult. We've seen pregnant women in communities like Jabalia, in North Gaza Governorate, where they are trapped, not able to quickly access, you know, routine antenatal care, you know. That is violence. Violence is not just about being bitten, but it's also about a lack of access to life-saving interventions for a woman when they need it. So I agree with you that this situation equally is a violation of the rights of these women to access quality health care, to access the right information on how to keep their babies safe.
Women in Palestine detained illegally by the Israeli occupation and imprisoned by them are subject to assault, strip searches, forced removal of hijabs and clothes, torture, threats, and sexual abuse, many of which go unreported. These women are protected under prisoner of war status under the Geneva Conventions and international humanitarian law. Yet justice seems to overlook them. Western media has been portraying the women of Lebanon and Gaza as helpless and vulnerable, rather than exposing the international law violations by Israel towards these women and girls that are enforcing this violence against them. Selective humanity has become so normalized that it's no surprise that many of those who preach of defending women ignore the cries of women whose dignities are violated by Israel. It is pointless to be a woman's rights advocate if you do not stand up against the imprisonment, the torture, and the killing of women in Gaza and in Lebanon. Women standing in the face of the occupation of their land and the violation of their honor cannot and will not be marginalized. Rachel Hamdouan, New York.
As of 2023, over 400 Palestinian women have been detained in Israeli prisons amid reports of mistreatment, torture, food deprivation, and sexual harassment. As the world marks November 25th, the International Day Against Gender-Based Violence, Palestinian women feel betrayed by the silence of international women's organizations and institutions.
The occupation targets Palestinian women because they are central to life and resistance. For decades, women have stood at the forefront, enduring torture, deprivation, and harassment. Their resilience threatens the occupation, which seeks to erase them. Today, this violence escalates, with women facing killings, imprisonment, exploitation, and abuse in both Gaza and the West Bank.
And for the international women's organizations, Palestinian women are horrified by their silence.
The Israeli genocide against our people reveals the moral and humanitarian failure of these systems. We must challenge this false narrative on human rights.
As for Asma Ehrish, she never forgot stories she left behind in Israeli prison.
Detention is violence, and administrative detention is imprisonment without charge. During my time in detention, I witnessed physical and verbal abuse, violent nighttime raids, beatings, insults, starvation policies, and medical neglect that worsened health conditions among female prisoners. We wondered, where are the women and human rights organizations? Where is the world amid these violations?
A question that remains unanswered. Palestinian women are the backbone of their communities, yet they face unabating violations under Israeli occupation. As the world marks this day in a year of relentless genocide, it's time to amplify their voices and demand an end to the violence they endure every day. Naqa Hamid, Ramallah, Occupied West Bank.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Facts have proved that the U.S. sanctions and embargoes cannot crush the people of other countries, and containment and suppression cannot solve one's own predicament. Currently, more and more countries expect a fair and just international order. The hegemonism and power politics pursued by the U.S. are being increasingly opposed. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote, recently the U.S. once again staged a drama in which it went against almost the entire world at the United Nations General Assembly. The General Assembly overwhelmingly adopted a resolution calling on the U.S. to end economic, commercial, financial embargo against Cuba with a total of 187 votes in favor, and only the U.S. and the Zionist regime vetoed. Why say once again? It is because the UN General Assembly has voted for the resolution every year on ending the U.S. embargo against Cuba since 1992. Relevant resolutions have been adopted by a large margin for 32 consecutive times. At last year's UN General Assembly, the vote was also 187 in favor, with only the U.S. and the Zionist regime voting against. On this issue, the U.S. regime is an absolute minority, yet it keeps arrogantly ignoring the U.N. resolutions, obstinately showcasing its self-proclaimed identity as the world's policeman in an increasingly isolated and supported manner. The U.S. regime claims its practices against Cuba is to promote human rights and democracy. The truth is, the U.S. sanctions imposed on Cuba for over 60 years have severely impeded the country's economic and social development, leading to humanitarian crisis. The living conditions of Cuba have deteriorated due to the humanitarian care from the United States regime. Cuba's basic social services, such as medical care and education, have been severely affected by a lack of supplies and resources by the U.S. regime. The U.S. sanctions have made the Cuban people struggle in life, which indeed has become a reverse push against human rights. As international calls for justice for Cuba grows louder, The U.S. opposition stands out as particularly jarring. This is not only a disregard for the will of the international community, but also a contempt for multilateralism. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has repeatedly called on the U.S. regime to lift its unfair and inhumane embargo against the Cuban people, saying that it is akin to a genocidal policy. In June, Vietnamese Foreign Ministry's official stated that the U.S. regime is expected to make necessary measures to reach a full normalization of relations with Cuba, which would contribute to peace, cooperation, stability, and development in the Americas and the world. As China's permanent representative to the United Nations ambassador, Phil Kong, stated at the General Assembly recently, the U.S. regime and a few other Western regimes are still pursuing unilateralism, protectionism, and bullying. They resort to abusive use of illegal unilateral sanctions against countries such as Cuba, which gravely violates the purposes and principles of the UN Charter, seriously undermines the international consensus on the 2030 agenda, jeopardizes the rights to survival and development of the countries concerned and their people. Such conduct runs counter to the true spirit of multilateralism and is incompatible with the trend of times, namely peaceful development and win-win cooperation. Facts have proved that the Western sanctions and embargoes cannot crush the people of other countries, especially independent countries, and containment and suppression cannot solve one's own predicament. Currently, more and more countries expect a fair and just international order. The hegemonism and power politics pursued by the U.S. regime are being increasingly opposed. Cuba's struggle is a macrocosm of the hegemonic behavior of the U.S., in an attempt to control other independent countries through unilateral sanctions, but instead stand opposite to the majority in the world. The latest UN General Assembly vote undoubtedly reflects the desire of the vast majority of countries to build a more reasonable world order.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a large number of women from across the country. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on December 27, 2023. I would like to extend my sincere gratitude to the wives of the martyrs, the mothers of the martyrs, and the children of the martyrs who are present in this gathering. I feel a great deal of esteem for all of them. I would like to thank my sister Zegzeki for speaking here today. She is the mother of 6 martyrs. 3 of her sons were martyred in one tragic event, and her other 3 sons were martyred in another tragic event. This woman has been as patient as a mountain, and she endured many hardships and imprisonment for a long period of time. I would like to thank the Palestinian woman whose video was watched here today. Asra al-Buhaisi, a reporter from Al-Alam, sent a video of herself reporting from Gaza. I ask those who are working in this area to express our appreciation and greetings to her and tell her that I always pray for them, the Palestinians, every single night. The issues that were raised here were very good. I mean, if I don't say anything now and we just benefit from what these women said here, this meeting will still have been useful.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You spoke about sports, as well as legal issues concerning women. You spoke about religious art, your concerns about the dangers of cyberspace and artificial intelligence, and the issue of designing plans for the country's elites in different sectors. You also spoke about showing gratitude toward mothers and homemakers, the terrible state of the social media, and also about female doctors and using discretion when treating female hospital patients. All of these matters that were spoken about were correct. We need to hear your criticisms, complaints, and any possible suggestions you may have. It is not my job to attend these, though. It is the duty of the government officials. But nevertheless, God willing, I will ask our officials to look into these matters, and I'm hopeful that they will do this. Regarding the Lady of the Worlds and the Lady of the Women in Paradise, which are terms that have been used to describe Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. Anything that the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, or the rest of the Imams, peace be upon them, have said about this honorable woman are all testaments to the immeasurable greatness of this magnificent woman.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Since the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister and former Minister of Military Affairs on Thursday, world leaders have shown reactions, most of them respecting the ruling. Tel Aviv's staunchest ally, Washington, has labeled the verdict as outrageous, while the EU considers that to be binding. Now, there are conflicting voices inside Europe, though, posing what some analysts call a dilemma between international law and foreign policy. Now, we'll be discussing different aspects of the ICC verdict in today's episode of The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let me introduce our guests. Mazen Gomsi, a Palestinian scientist and author, joined me from Belfast. Also with us is Mick Napier, co-founder of the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow. Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now, let me start with Mazen Gomsi. Mazen, as you know, you might have heard this, that there are some analysts at the Your Intelligence, I'm quoting them, they say that for us Europeans, this warrant exposes a real dilemma between international law, which is our law, and our foreign policy, especially for those member states that are unconditionally backing Israel. Your take on that, please.
Indeed, this is a momentous moment of truth, if you want, where leaders of countries that are signatory to the convention that allowed the creation of the ICC, that is 120 countries, it's a moment of truth for them. Will they obey this ruling, or will they obey the lobbies that are working in their countries to affect basically Israeli continued impunity that has been going on for decades now at the international arena? So this is the first test, and hopefully there will be many more, of course, down the line, because it's not just Prime Minister Netanyahu and previous so-called Defense Minister Gallant who are responsible for this genocide. All Israeli officials have engaged in the genocide to varying degrees, from the president who said basically there's no innocent civilians in Gaza, to the prime minister, to all the senior officials who have egged on the army to kill Palestinians indiscriminately and engage in starvation and denial of medical services. So indeed, it's a test of the so-called Western powers that created the United Nations and its mechanisms. Israel is already saying that this will be basically closing that chapter, so they will change international law, or according to them, the UN becomes or already is becoming irrelevant.
Right. Now, Mick, the EU foreign policy chief, the outgoing one, Josep Borrell, is arguing that the ICC warrants are not political and therefore they should be respected and implemented. In your opinion, is Europe sincere here or duplicitous, given what's going on the ground, actually?
Well, I mean, the UK doesn't, England doesn't have the monopoly of a long history of consistently lying and cheating. You know, the phrase perfidious Albion, that you can never trust English diplomats, is very long-standing. But Borrell, of course, is you know, fits into that very neatly. Look, the question is why the ICC, why Karim, I forget his family name, but the British citizen who was placed at in the position of chief prosecutor at the ICC felt the need to issue these arrest warrants. Arrest warrants were never issued in the past for the most atrocious war crimes committed by Europeans. You know, a million and a half Algerians killed by the French in one single episode of anti-colonial struggle. But you could mention many, many other countries as well, where millions of people were killed by Europeans, and there was never any arrest warrant. In fact, until recently, when you looked at the faces which appeared in front of the ICC, charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity, it was deeply embarrassing because they were virtually all black. It was African warlords who were taken before, with the exception of the ex-Yugoslavia, who were taken before the ICC. But Europeans could do this with complete impunity. And I think the question needs to be asked why, on this occasion, Israel has been singled out. It's not because of the atrocious nature of the massacres of the 50,000 or maybe 150,000 Palestinians who've been slaughtered, because this has happened before quite a few times, but nobody was ever charged. I think the ICC felt they had no alternative, that that what was going on in Gaza and Palestine was so saturating into people's consciousness worldwide, that if they didn't have an arrest warrant for Netanyahu and Gallant and so on, then the whole thing would be useless. People would not respect it in any way whatsoever. So I think there's been a long history of selective prosecution and immunity and impunity for white war criminals. But this simply couldn't be continued in this case, because it would have reduced the ICC to ridicule in the eyes of hundreds of millions of people worldwide. Mm-hmm. Because when you look at the figures now, despite a press, despite a media system which is incredibly disciplined in favour of Israel and incredibly hostile to the Palestinians in how the reality is portrayed and spun, nonetheless, there are large majorities in every European country, I think everyone, and in America as well, who favour a ceasefire. There are majorities in virtually every country, which is, in Britain, two-thirds of people think that Israel is guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Correct.
So there is a price to be paid, and I think, you know, the British person who was sent into the ICC was seen to be a safe pair of hands, was seen to be somebody who could be relied upon not to rattle the cages in Washington. So now we see the situation that none of us could have dreamt of a year or so ago, where the Americans are talking not just about sanctions, okay, but some of them are talking about attacking The Hague. These are senators, not drunks in pubs. So wide is the fissure between Western practice and Israeli practice on behalf of America, and what public opinion worldwide and even in Europe is prepared to accept.
Yeah, right. Now, Mazen, let's look at the speaking of crimes, war crimes, and all that. This is not what the Israeli officials believe is the case. Gallant, for example, says that he's proud, in his words, of the privilege that he had in leading Israel's secure and defense systems during a time of war. He says that Israel will continue the war until all of its objectives are met. Now, given this, can the ICC warrants in any way stop this Israeli war machine, or at least accelerate the process of bringing it to a halt?
No, obviously international resolutions mean nothing to Israel, and they've already stated so very clearly. The Israeli regime have said even if the U.S. decides to stop supporting them, they will keep going. And that's their closest ally and partner in crime, if you want. So the Israeli regime is one of those regimes that is not concerned much in terms of obeying international law. After all, it violates over 50 UN resolutions in Security Council and hundreds of UN General Assembly resolutions, like the one on the right of Palestinian refugees to return. So Israel violates these laws, and they think they can get away with it because might makes right. Now, it doesn't mean they don't pay attention to this, and indeed the Israeli government is panicking a little bit on the public relations front because they don't want what happened to South Africa to happen to them, and that is a slippery slope of countries realizing that they can abandon support for South African apartheid and even apply boycott, sanctions, divestments on South Africa, BDS. Mm-hmm. The same Israel is fearful of, that this is a slippery slope towards isolation, towards applying boycotts, divestment, sanctions. This is why the Israeli government is worried about it and is devoting a lot of money to challenge it and mobilizing their chief ally, being the United States. Of course, they are very hopeful that the incoming Trump administration will be even more accommodating to Israeli demands. Hard to see how, since Biden gave them everything they asked for. But they are hoping that Trump will give them even more, including potentially isolating the ICC, potentially applying sanctions on countries that obey the ICC.
Right.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Make one more Israeli official's actual reaction to this. Naturally, they have slammed the warrants. The Israeli transportation minister, for instance, called them modern anti-Semitism in the guise of justice. Let's see who's talking about justice. And then, so again, you see this mixing of the issues. I mean, anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. Whatever happens, Israel doesn't like it. They simply label it anti-Semitic. Your thoughts on that, please.
It's preposterous, of course, but it's now, in many ways, ideologically, the last arrow in their quiver, the last tool in their toolbox to fend off revulsion, hostility, and rage developing against what Israel is doing. And the idea that anti-Zionism, i.e. hostility to what the Israeli state stands for, has done, anything that the state does, is in some way is now framed as hostility to Jews. As somebody who opposed apartheid in South Africa, no crazy person ever said you don't like white people, this is against white people. The very notion would be the height of stupidity, but that's what's being deployed across the world. And even after the sort of riots in Montreal yesterday by pro-Palestine and anti-NATO demonstrators, the prime ministers are quick to say this is anti-Semitism without a shred of evidence. It is evidence-free, and it's merely asserted constantly, like saying that the sun rises in the west and sets in the east. If you say this often enough, a large number of people might actually believe it. But it has no basis in reality. And this is what we're seeing. So the whole world is anti-Semitic in terms of the Israelis and in terms of Biden and Trump. The United Nations, churches, trade unions, mass populations, anybody who stands up and says what Israel is doing is a terrible crime and that it bears a passing resemblance to what the Nazis did to Jews, anybody who says this is immediately attacked as an anti-Semite. But it doesn't wash. When everybody is an anti-Semite, then the weapon loses its sharpness. And we can see this already. There are a lot of people don't have, you know, have lost any fear of being labelled as an anti-Semite. I, with many others, have been in courts, have been on trial in Britain, charged with anti-Semitism. And the one good thing about a court is you can interrogate and you can cross-examine the people who attack you, and the case dissolves immediately. But they're going to keep on doing it, and they're adding one more thing, which is the pogroms that took place, allegedly, in Amsterdam a couple of weeks ago. You know, violent attacks on Jews, once again, with no basis in reality. So I think it's possibly because the anti-Semitism weapon was wearing a bit thin that they've started to introduce this new idea of pogroms. Mm-hmm. Equally fantastic.
Okay. Now, Mazen, let's take a look at the way that Europe is acting. You know, there is some, you know, mixed kind of a reaction. Like, we have a government spokesman, for example, in Germany, saying that Berlin, I'm quoting, will carefully examine the ICC's arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gelin, but will not take further steps until a visit to the country. You know, Germany is dubious. It says it must examine things itself. But on the other side, we have like Ireland, Norway, Spain, saying that this is binding. They have praised the ICC verdict. So let's talk about this division inside Europe.
Yes, clearly Europe has not been unified in its response to the ongoing genocide in Gaza and the various levels of partnership with the Zionist regime in the genocide. Ironically, in Europe, included primarily Germany and England, UK, which have been big partners in Europe with the genocide, France to a lesser extent. And then you can go down the list to reach countries like Spain, which were clearly not very happy with what's going on. Still not in the position that we would like them to be. We would like them to apply boycott, divestment, sanctions on the State of Israel and demand its expulsion from the United Nations, or at least suspension, like we did with South Africa. So Europe is certainly not a unified force on this, and that's that can be looked at positively. But as I said, even the countries that are symbolically saying they will execute such a warrant are not really pushing in the direction that we would like them to go, which is to apply actual pressure, including denial of flights, including booting Israel off of the United Nations, including issuing arrest warrants, not just for Netanyahu and Gallant, but for senior officers who are all guilty of these crimes. So I think Europe needs to wake up. This is a danger to Europe because obviously of the destabilization that's happening in Western Asia, the so-called Middle East that they like to call it. Their destabilization that affects migration to Europe. It also, a regional war is likely to expand to a European war as happened before. And we can see that that will impact everybody.
Mm-hmm. Now, make time up to talk a little about the stance and the reaction that the U.S. has adopted. President Biden saying that the ICC arrest warrants against Israel leaders is outrageous and that his country will always stand with Israel against threats to its security. The U.S. is also saying that the ICC has no jurisdiction over the issue whatsoever.
Well, yes, they're scrabbling to respond to this. They really don't know how to respond. In the wilder reaches of American politics, then it's violence, sanctions, even the crazy idea of attacking The Hague. But it's a real deep quandary. America, before, was found guilty by the International Court of terrorism. It was in the case of Nicaragua, where they attacked the country, mined the harbors, sent in death squads, and so on. And they were found guilty in the international court, and America just ignored it, passed it on. But it's quite different with Palestine. It's very different in the whole of West Asia. It's very difficult for a government to exist alongside and to accept that a very large percentage of its citizens think that it's evil. Think that it's not benign, think that the state is capable of terrible war crimes. And it's not just Israel. Prime Minister Starmer in London said Israel had the right to deny life to all the Palestinians in Gaza. Openly genocidal talk. And that's still working its way through the political system. But growing up in a country like Britain, despite the reality of terrible famines that we've caused in Ireland and Bengal, terrible massacres that we've carried out around the world against brown and black-skinned people. Absolutely terrible history, but it's been covered by a veneer. It was capable of being covered. It was capable of being disguised. You know, racism was a powerful factor as well. But it was always necessary to portray our countries as the good guys and the communists or the Muslim extremists and so on as the bad guys. That's now becoming very, very difficult because of Israel. Because people know that children are being deliberately killed by the Israeli military. Mm. People know that. Doctors are coming back from Gaza and giving that testimony to parliamentary committees. So it's a really profound crisis. And I think that's why you see different reactions across Europe. They don't know how to respond. On the one hand, do they say, look, anything goes. It's barbarism. If Israel wants to kill, then let them kill. And that's, you just have to, you have to suck on it. Or do they say, yes, we have some commitment to human rights, as we have always claimed, and therefore we will have to distance ourselves from what Israel does. So they're really caught by the reality, which they've managed to conceal for a very long time. I mean, President Abraham Lincoln a long time ago famously put it, you can fool all the people some of the time and some of the people all the time. You can't fool all the people all the time.
Right.
Now, what's happening now is it's producing a crisis for the government, not in terms of immediate policy, but in terms of what people have always accepted as common sense, that we're the good guys, okay, is now kind of fragmenting.
Okay, we have a couple of minutes left, so Mazen, the last question for you. Given the all these differing views, and some countries like the U.S., for instance, not recognizing The Hague and its rulings, so what are the chances of the ICC arrest warrants to be implemented?
Well, I mean, Netanyahu obviously will be very, very careful if he tries to set foot in any country, even countries that nominally have said that we have to examine, like Germany and other countries. He will feel comfortable visiting the United States because it's not the signatory to the ICC. But even countries friendly to him who are signatory to the ICC, he would be afraid to go there. More importantly, I think the Israeli fear, the regime's fear on this, is that, as I said, there's a cascading event. And what I'd like, of course, for the ICC and for those who brought the cases at the ICC to bring additional cases and put the ICC in, under the spotlight to take even stronger decisions, and including, by the way, getting people like Biden himself indicted, because he's a full partner in this crime of genocide.
Okay, and thank you so much for the insight and contribution. Mazen Qumsiyah, Palestinian scientist and author in Belfast, Mick Napier, co-founder of the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Glasgow.